Today is March the 17th, 2021. It's St. Patrick's Day, or the Feast of St. Patrick, the foremost patron saint of Ireland. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available from prn.fm on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Apple is spring cleaning their product offerings. Apple, rest in peace, HomePod. Long live the HomePod Mini. Apple is reportedly discontinuing its original HomePod smart speaker as the company pivots focus to the HomePod Mini, its smaller and more affordable baby brother. Confirmation from Apple that it is shelving the HomePod Mini just a few short years after its initial launch. Reviews weren't kind when Apple's voice control smart speaker first hit shelves in 2018. Critics argued it admittedly high-quality sound wasn't worth the hassle of dealing with Apple's walled garden and its steep $349 price tag, which is much more expensive than Amazon's Echo or Amazon's Nest line of smart speakers. As if it wasn't enough, the HomePod also had a bizarre tendency to stain people's furniture. Apple lowered the price to $299 a year later, but that apparently wasn't enough to save it, seeing as Apple's now putting the HomePod out to pasture. The HomePod Mini, on the other hand, received a much warmer reception. This tinier version of Apple's first-generation smart speaker launched in November with a $99 price tag. It's still more expensive than its diminutive competitors, the Echo Dot or the Nest Mini, but on par with Amazon and Google's mid-tier options. In a statement to multiple outlets, Apple said the HomePod Mini has been a hit since its debut, so much so that the company opted to exclusively focus on its tiniest speaker. Apple's statement is as follows. HomePod Mini has been a hit since its debut last fall, offering customers amazing sound, an intelligent assistant, and smart home control all for just $99. We are focusing our efforts on HomePod Mini. We are discontinuing the original HomePod. It will continue to be available while supplies last through the Apple online store, Apple retail stores, and Apple authorized resellers. Apple will provide HomePod customers with software updates and service and support through Apple Care. The original HomePod isn't the only product en route for the Apple graveyard. Last week, Apple announced it's discontinuing the iMac Pro, its $5,000 workstation, after just 4 years on the market. Both the iMac and iMac Pro are made of aluminum, are designed as all-in-one computers, with Apple recently refreshing the higher-end iMacs with newer processors and graphic cards. CNN reported Apple is no longer making the iMac Pro, once the most powerful computer the company offered. For those looking to get their hands on the all-in-one Mac, they can still do so for a limited time. The $5,000 standard model can still be purchased on Apple's website, but only while supplies last. Once existing inventory runs out, the iMac Pro will no longer be available. Apple released the iMac Pro in 2017, in which it was deemed the most powerful Mac ever. The all-in-one computer aimed at creatives and professional features, advanced capabilities for graphics and 3D rendering. However, the machine hasn't gotten any major updates in the past few years. In August, Apple debuted its 27-inch iMac, which is the go-to iMac option for most customers. The tech company added that the current model can be configured to address the needs of professionals. But for those desiring a boost in performance and expandability, they can choose a Mac Pro, a Mac tower that exceeds the capabilities of the iMac Pro. Apple is gearing up for a new release of iMacs this year to replace the 21.5-inch and 27-inch models, as reported by Bloomberg in January. Apple reportedly overestimated iPhone 12 mini demand by a lot. It's cutting production by 70%. That's huge. Apple is cutting production of the iPhone 12 mini in the first half of this year. Planned production of the smallest iPhone 12 model has reportedly been reduced by 70% or more in the first half of this year, making up the majority of a 20% cut in total iPhone 12 production. Some suppliers have been asked to temporarily stop producing iPhone 12 mini specific components, while other parts are being reallocated to the Pro and Pro Max. Alongside the iPhone production news, Nikkei also reports that Apple has pushed back production for two new Apple Silicon MacBooks, originally due to enter mass production in May or June. The laptops will now be manufactured in the second half of the year. Nikkei's report doesn't reveal which of Apple's rumored MacBooks these could be. iPhone production is still expected to be up overall compared to 2020. Despite the cuts, iPhone production is still scheduled to be up overall compared to 2020. Apple reportedly plans to produce 75 million handsets in the first half of the year and 230 million phones over the course of 2021. Part of the reason, though, is that because Apple was overly aggressive in booking up production capacity in the first place ahead of the global chip shortage. The shortage is now creating problems for companies both inside and outside of the technology industry. Nikkei's report is the latest indication that Apple's miniature, in addition to its flagship smartphone lineup, hasn't lived up to expectations. Last month, Reuters reported on analyst data which claimed sales of the 12 mini had made up just 5% of Apple's smartphone sales in the first half of January. Nikkei reports that as of the end of last year, the mini made up 10 to 15% of Apple's iPhone series orders. Overall, smartphone demand is trending towards phones with bigger screens, and while the 12 mini is also benefits from being cheaper than the other handsets in the iPhone lineup, customers have the option of buying previous year's models if they want to save money. Apple will randomize Mac serial numbers starting this year. The new system may be more cryptic for IT users and repair shops. According to Mac rumors, Apple will completely change how the serial numbers for Macs are generated. The numbers will soon be fully randomized, meaning that users, IT managers, repair shop technicians, and others will not be able to glean the same information from them that the current serial number provides. Third-party Mac repair shops will gain access to Apple tools and parts. Serial numbers on Macs shipping today reflect the time and place where the Mac was assembled, as well as some configuration details like storage capacity. Moving forward, serial numbers will be fully random with no code or consistency that can be used to learn information about the product. The new numbers will be between 8 and 14 characters long. Mac Rumor claims it learned of the change when it gained access to an internal Apple Care email. This change does not apply to Mac models that are shipping today, but it will go into effect for future Macs that the company will introduce. That includes the Rumor MacBook Air, MacBook Pro, and iMac, refreshers expected later this year, as well as the new Mac Pro models that appear to be planned for a later date. According to the email, the change was initially planned to go into effect in 2020, but it was pushed back. The email now says it will happen in early 2021. Curiously, the most reliable rumors and leaks about upcoming products have placed them in the second half of 2021, with only iPad refreshers initially expected in the coming weeks. But the date may refer to something besides the product's final ship date. We'll just have to wait and see. Serial numbers are used in online forums, repair shops, and company IT departments to expedite troubleshooting and other tasks by quickly learning more about the machine in question. For example, when a computer that is exhibiting a problem that is part of a certain set of models manufactured in a certain time period that all have that issue, some of that information will still be accessible after either booting the machine up or taking it apart. Apple has not publicly confirmed this change or explained the reason. M1 Mac users are reporting that they are experiencing excessive solid-state drive usage, potentially affecting the component's lifespan. Some M1 Macs are seeing absurd levels of write activity on their costly internal SSDs. What's the issue? There are numerous reports from M1 Mac users that Mac OS is giving out worrying hard drive health reports, which could indicate severe lifespan problems. Some advanced users have been reporting an overuse of the solid-state drive for writing and reading data on the newly released Macs with M1, Apple's first computer chip based on ARM architecture. The issue could eventually affect the lifespan of the internal SSD used in M1 Macs, not to mention the machine itself. Some more professional users of the new M1 MacBooks are experiencing extremely high drive writes over a relatively short time. The most severe cases have consumed about 10 to 13% of the maximum warrantable TBW value of the solid-state drives. Since solid-state drives are based on chips rather than mechanical parts, they all have a predetermined lifespan based on how much they are used for writing and reading data. The more you write data onto a solid-state drive, the faster it will shorten the number of available writes. As the internal storage of M1 Macs are soldered to the logic board, users will have to replace the entire computer if affected by the solid-state drive defect. Today's report suggests that the lifespan of the M1 Mac's internal solid-state drive can be reduced to as little as 2 years. Unfortunately, the reasons behind this problem are still unknown. This could be either the M1 chip constantly using the Mac's internal storage for memory swap, which is basically using the solid-state drive as virtual RAM, or just another bug found in Mac OS operating system. Apple has yet commented on this issue. Some context is useful. Let's start with the fact that NAND flash, the underlying medium in almost all solid-state drives, is a terrible storage medium, which means there's a lot of firmware between your write and the medium that you hope that it is stored on. There is limited write life, dependent on the number of bits per cell. That is to say, is a solid-state drive is single bit, 2 bits, or 3 bits per cell. In search of specifications, there is none published by Apple. Solid-state drives or devices store information by being charged with different voltages. The simplest solid-state drive only store a single bit of information in each cell, a 0 or a 1. Multi, which is 2-bit, and 3-level ones use 2 or 3-level respectively to store 2 or 3-bit data. In the act of writing to the flash memory cell, that degrades it. Each memory cell within a solid-state drive has an oxide component, 2 layers of one or another chemical mixed with oxygen. Electrons are trapped between those oxide layers. Multi- and triple-level cells have multiple levels and therefore many different states have to be read. Since the margins between different cell states are narrower, even a small amount of wear can cause electron capacity issues that make it impossible to record the correct state. But where is the problem likely to be? In order of likelihood, the reporting software based on smart monitoring from hard drives is mischaracterization of the solid-state activity. Smart was a good idea, haphazardly implement across many but not all drives firmware. It should not be used for solid-state drives. Or it could be solid-state drive controller firmware is misreporting write activity. Solid-state drive controller firmware is complex due to the limitation of NAND flash. Mitigating write amplification requires careful juggling of DRAM buffers in the controller to ensure that only necessary data gets written to flash. Each solid-state drive manufacturer determines the number of charge cycles a cell can endure before it becomes too unreliable to read and monitors actual cycles against this number to provide a wear rating as a percentage. A large part of what makes M1 Max so fast is that the chips use what's known as unified memory architecture. This means that RAM is shared between the main processor, graphics, and neural engine as required. The architecture also makes much freer use of the solid-state drive, using this interchangeably with RAM to a great extent than seen on Intel machines. What caused alarm was when M1 owners started checking their solid-state drive wear and seeing what appears to be alarmingly high levels after just a few months of use. Some more professional users of the new M1 MacBooks are experiencing extremely high drive writes over a relatively short time. The most severe cases have caused about 10 to 13% of maximum warrantable or TBW value of their solid-state drives, given their capacity and using values for equivalent market-available non-volatile memory express drives. The less RAM you have, the more use will be made of the solid-state drive, and the smaller your solid-state drive, the greater the wear on each cell. In an extreme example, an M1 Mac with 8 GB of RAM and 256 GB of solid-state drive could hit its rated wear level in less than 6 months. So, if you're configuring an M1 Mac, you want to factor in the solid-state drive wear. If you expect your usage to be RAM-intensive and or write a lot of data, then 16 GB of RAM is better than 8 GB, and a large solid-state drive is better than a small one. But Apple doesn't provide the specifications of what they installed on the solid-state drive, and that is cause for difficulty in determining what the system configuration should be. Gamers are rushing to scoop up retro TVs. Here's everything you need to know about buying a top-tier chunky TV. Well, you can't buy one. You have to see if you can get one. The cathode ray tube, also known as CRT television, was the primary technology behind television for decades. In many key ways, like input lag, it's still the best method for producing an image. But shortly after the turn of the millennium, that's the year 2000, flat panel televisions became all the rage due to their convenience, price, and space-saving abilities. When they eventually came to tout 720p and 1080p images, the writing was on the wall for CRTs. The reasons this was a huge mistake, at least for retro gamers, is that thousands of games were designed with CRTs in mind. Some games, like the original Mega Man series, are almost unplayable without the twitchy, instant control native to the CRT experience. Emulators can compensate for this in various complex ways that just aren't worthwhile for most people. CRT TVs have a specific look that is hard to put into words. If you haven't seen one lately, one that remains unachievable via OLED or LCD. Sure, you can turn on your modern TV's game mode and play using emulators that add false curves to your screen or fake scanline filters, but that will forever be a pale imitation of the CRT's glow. There are also only place left to experience games that were designed to use active shutter 3D classes or light guns. These technologies depend on the specific way CRT display an image, meaning games or accessories need to be completely reworked around whatever display technology is currently in vogue. You may have made your way through the second-hand stores or shops like Goodwill, and oftentimes these units can look dusty or faded thanks to their years, But don't let the aging facades deceive you. As long as the screen and the tubes are good, you're good to go. However, always test a used TV before you purchase it, lest you discover it's defective and need to learn the intricacy of recycling such a heavy object. To that end, it could be useful to bring some form of media with matching inputs when evaluating a set. Primarily, though, you'll want to get your hands on a Sony unit, if at all possible. Sony TVs are legendary, particularly their Trinitron line, and can only count Panasonic and Hitachi among their equals. Thankfully, the brand was quite popular and many sets are still floating around, waiting to find a loving home once again. A word of caution, CRT TVs are objects from another era, when our homes and cultures are quite different. Any television of such size and weight will need a dedicated place in your home, away from anywhere children could accidentally knock a unit over. CRTs also generate quite a bit of static electricity and heat, so be sure and warn anyone who may want to mess around with such a unit during the operation. Once you own one, these older TVs have a way of, well, warming a spot in your heart. Truly, there's nothing like playing N64 on a CRT. It simply doesn't look the same on any other display, or watching a DVD movie without all the HD remastering that you'll find on streaming services. CRT TVs are a must-have for any serious retro gamer. That will only get harder to find or repair as time goes on. If you'd like to preserve your access to technology's incredible colors, wide viewing angles, and instant response time, picking up and maintaining a CRT is more than worth the trouble. And here I thought CRTs were gone forever. This is almost like vinyl records. They're back in style.
The installed base of Linux is greater than all other operating systems combined. There are people who say they don't like Linux and refer to it as that desktop operating system that has all text and no GUI. There are literally hundreds of Linux distros after it was first released in December 8, 1992. You may think there's no one distro that has become a de facto standard. Not true. There is one version with an installed base greater than all other Linux distros combined. You may not know how many are using Linux today, but 85% of all smartphones are powered by Linux. Smartphones are powered by Linux are, for a fact, dominating the smartphone market. Most of you know Google's Android and Chrome OS are operating distributions, both originally based on the Linux kernel. Android smartphones are powered by Linux. Android is an operating system based on the Linux kernel, or as Google's developers put it, Android is built on the open Linux kernel as of Android 11. Android sits on the long-term support, that's LTS, Linux kernel, namely based on Linux kernel versions 4.19 and 5.4. To be more specific, since 2019, the Linux mainline is now merged into the Android mainline whenever Linus Torvalds posts a release or release candidate. Before 2019, Android common kernels were constructed by cloning the recently declared LTS kernel and adding the Android-specific patches. This new model avoids the significant effort to forward port and test Android patches by accomplishing the same result incrementally. Google explains that Android's Linux kernel has further architectural changes outside the typical Linux kernel. Is Android really just Linux? Google's open source chief, Chris DeBona, refers to Android as a Linux desktop dream come true. Linux kernel runs on 85% of all smartphones. A recent study done by IDC reveals that Android has fortified itself in the smartphone market. The study released in November of 2020 said that 262 million smartphones shipped during that quarter and 85% were Androids. According to Gartner and Statista, Android now boasts a global market share of 86%. The smartphone market share by mainly the top two smartphone operating system distributors are Android and Apple, which runs iOS. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Downsides of tech in business for us.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I spend just a little bit of time talking about computers, the business world, and how it affects all of us. This week, I'm going to tackle part one of two in regards to technology and the workplace. This week, I want to talk about some of the bad things in regards to technology, as far as I see them, and how our businesses, our employers, our companies are really making it hard for us to truly have a life. It's more than that. It's ways that technology in the industry is hurting all of society. Let's talk about my first. It's a pet peeve of mine. Technology is addictive. We all know that, yes, you would probably give up food for a day rather than give up your smartphone for a day. That's pretty bad. When you think about that, the top four items for survivability are air, water, food, and shelter. Yes, food, third place on the list. People would do that. And that is how addictive our smartphones are to us. So we're already in the middle of fighting an addiction. And what does our company do? They give us a smartphone. Or they require us to be available via our smartphone. Or yes, they shove us in front of a computer for 40 hours a week, every week, for the rest of our lives. This is something that is a necessary evil, that we do have to rely on technology for a lot of our jobs. Many of us. I was at a Home Depot recently, and the high-tech system that they have at Home Depot, it was amazing. I was looking over their shoulder. They were struggling with a few different problems with my purchase. But I was watching, and it was an amazing system. But you know what? It was just a general clerk that was having to deal with all of these different things and know where all of the icons were and what they did and all of that. And that's fine. But we are now spending, as adults, we are spending more than 11 hours a day in the digital world. And it's no wonder that we're addicted. But we're perpetuating this in a number of different ways because, okay, technology has brought to the workplace a number of different enablers that the employer thinks, oh, this is great. Let's monitor all of the employees and see how much they're actually utilizing their computer. Well, wait a second. Yes, they've been monitoring your traffic on the internet for many years. We'll say decades now. And they've been monitoring all of that, but now they're actually monitoring your keystrokes. How fast does Benjamin type over here? Is he typing, books of reams of paper every day? I shouldn't even say reams of paper because for the most part, we're not even printing anymore. But now we're also monitoring people via metrics to see how much widgets they do. And widgets is just a generic term. It can be how many different declines you do, how many customers you serve, how many approvals you do, how many sales that you make. Whatever it is, they're monitoring everything. And if you're not a high performer and it's time to trim a few people, yes, you could be the next one. So they know if you're wasting time, if you're away from the computer, and yet that perpetuates your whole existence of being a technology addict. So there's other ways that technology is really hurting us. I mean, we're all leading sedentary lifestyles now. Yes, we are having a whole host of issues in regards to, yes, your posture. Think about your posture for just a moment. I know my posture is suffering. My vision is, okay, I'm of that age where, yes, I'm going to start needing reading glasses. I fortunately don't. Part of that is because I am slightly nearsighted, which is fine. I can see really well, farsighted as well. Not perfect. Almost, though, but here's the thing. We're all going through all of these different things, and it's really making things worse. That sedentary lifestyle is leading to all kinds of other issues, a host of issues, whether we're talking about heart disease or we're talking about obesity or diabetes. You know, this sedentary lifestyle is hitting us across the board, and it's perpetuated by technology. So has technology really helped us? Has technology made anything better in the workplace? And for this week, I'm going to argue it's hard to see. It's hard for me to really feel at this moment like we're so much more successful in the workplace, so much more successful in our lives because of technology, because of all of this. And next week, I'm going to actually turn it around. I'm going to give you some of the positive things, some of the wonderful things that technology has brought us, both personally and professionally in the workplace. Because, yes, it does exist. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Has anyone ever wondered why there's no UHF Channel 37? It doesn't exist? With over-the-air television channels, they sit in the VHF and UHF frequency ranges. Many other devices operate in the UHF frequency. There are ham radio operations, two-way land mobile radio systems, such as walkie-talkies, two-way radios in vehicles, and for portable wireless devices, cordless phones and cell phones operate in the UHF frequency, but UHF channel 37 does not exist. In the United States and Canada, the VHF television band occupies frequencies between 54 and 216 megahertz, and the UHF band between 470 and 890 megahertz. In general, VHF channels are numbered 2 to 13, and UHF channels 14 to 51. In 1952, the year that the U.S. Federal Communications Commission opened up the television system to use UHF, or ultra-high frequency signals, the practical effects of this addition of bandwidth was that the total number of potential TV stations increased dramatically from 108 to 2,051 overnight. The first UHF application was granted on July 11, 1952. Within a 600-mile radius of the city of Danville, Illinois, population 31,246, are numerous major cities, among them Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, Atlanta, Minneapolis, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, Toronto, and Washington, D.C. Nearly the entire length of the Mississippi River fits into that radius. If Danville was located just a little further to the east, the radius would also include Philadelphia and New York City. So, for all intents and purposes, a 600-mile radius from eastern Illinois covers basically the entire East Coast, except for the state of Florida and the Northeast. But there was something located in Danville that was important, and that thing was a 400-foot-wide radio telescope. Operating along the 610 megahertz frequency, it was something of a monster of astronomy at that time, operating 12 to 16 hours per day, and researchers at the University of Illinois aimed to keep it that way. The research that led to the creation of the radio telescope taught us more about the universe than we might have learned with a mere optical telescope. In 1931, a radio engineer and Bell Lab employee named Carl Jansky was trying to uncover the source of static that was interfering with radio waves. He found it had extraterrestrial source, particularly at the center in the Milky Way galaxy. Jansky wasn't an astronomer but an engineer, and despite discovering a new field of astronomy, his position at Bell Labs didn't allow him to pursue it further. But after World War II ended, others eventually did pursue radio astronomy, including George C. McVittle, a British cosmologist who built the astronomy department at the University of Illinois in 1950, and George Svensson, who helped to build the university's radio telescope. For engineering reasons, they could only build a really big one if they had a frequency of around 600 megahertz, so they pick upon the 610 megahertz band as the observing frequency. The area around the 610 megahertz band has, over the years, gained a reputation as being important to scientific research because of its placement in the context of the two other frequencies important to radio astronomy, 410 megahertz and 1.4 gigahertz. Without it, radio astronomers would lose a key window in the otherwise continuous radio wave of the sky. There was just one problem, though. The sudden high popularity of television made the general bandwidth area where the telescope operated at, 608 to 614 megahertz, a bit of a hot commodity. It was literally the spot where Channel 37 was supposed to go, and broadcasters wanted access to that channel. It threatened to cover up a key window, though. There were 18 stations that had been allocated to use Channel 37 in the United States in 1952. One of those communities was Paterson, New Jersey, located within New York City metro area. In the end, no Channel 37 actually ended up on the air in analog form in the United States. At the time the University of Illinois had built out its radio telescope, television was still in its infancy and not every TV could actually access UHF signals. But soon UHF went from optional upgrade to standard feature on television sets, and that meant this radio telescope was in the way. Fortunately for the scientists that rely on this telescope, they had the support of the global community. A meeting of the International Telecommunication Union in 1959 set aside a series of frequencies that were important for different scientific and technical uses. One of those frequencies was where Channel 37 sat. The University of Illinois, wanting to protect its radio telescope investment, went to the FCC in 1960, asking that Channel 37 be allocated to radio telescope exclusively. The University of Illinois was asking the American public to give up one television channel for science. The channel isn't being used very much, but it is being used in the neighborhood of New York and places like that. The FCC disagreed with the university's assessment, but just a couple years later, stations were starting to call the FCC up for access to that specific station, particularly one directly outside of the antenna's 600-mile radius in Paterson, New Jersey. Because of FCC rules and limitations elsewhere, the city of Paterson had no other option to bring a TV station on air other than Channel 37. But even with the channel being located hundreds of miles away and targeted at New York City market, there was concern among scientists that even faraway interference could get in the way of scientific research. The regulators, faced with a conflict that pitted a niche use case against a massive commercial windfall, tried to come up with a compromise. The compromise included no stations on Channel 37 within a 600-mile radius of an antenna until at least 1968, allowing the completion of a survey of radio star sources on the 610 megahertz frequency. Second was, no station anywhere listed under Channel 37 could air anything between midnight and 7 a.m. The FCC's attempt to balance science and commerce was not well accepted by the scientists, who then took their story to the media. The controversy was such that it appeared on the front page of the New York Times. A letter sent to the FCC suggests an appalling lack of comprehension within the FCC of the nature and the needs of radio astronomy, and yet the commission has the power to cripple and perhaps even destroy radio astronomy. In October 1963, the FCC announced the commission's decision to bar the use of Channel 37 in the United States. The FCC agreed to a 10-year moratorium on Channel 37 being used, which eventually became permanent. The commission didn't necessarily know how putting Channel 37 on the dial was going to impact scientific research in the long run, so best not to risk it. Ultimately, Channel 37 went completely unused throughout the analog era in much of North America, as well as most other countries, with only a handful of exceptions. Now let's fast forward to the year 2000, the year the FCC allowed for the use of wireless medical telemetry services, also known as devices that allow for tracking of patient vitals like heartbeat, wirelessly, on the same band as Channel 37. Despite existing constraints in these bands, this allocation is flexible enough to allow the spectrum to be available for medical telemetry services in all locations while protecting radio astronomy and government operations currently operating in the allocated spectrum. Think about this in terms of other things that have nothing to do with astronomy, like the internet. A year or two ago, there was a big brouhaha and conflict involving who owned the .org top-level domain, with commercial interests attempting to hone in on something intended to support nonprofits. The only reason it didn't happen, just like Channel 37 saga, was because people in the world of nonprofits and technology came together and lobbied against it. Ultimately, in the case of Channel 37, scientists were able to save a small sliver of what was mostly going to be otherwise used commercially. Presenting All Hands on Tech with Marty Winston, Coronavirus Chemical Warfare.
There are three things that get a lot of coverage related to coronavirus. One of those is the vaccines. And hey, it's gratifying to see some of the numbers dropping as more people get their first and second shots. One of those things is the basic preventatives, like wearing masks and social distancing. One of those things is the broad collection of tech products that claim to keep you safe from infection when, in fact, most don't. There's a fourth thing that you may want to understand, but first, you'll want to think about the difference between taking a breath and getting a little touchy. It's the difference between airborne contagion and touch contact surface contagion. Airborne contagion basically means inhaling the virus when it's in the ambient air around you. Most healthy people get infected when an infected person nearby exhales or speaks or coughs or sneezes. The very most common route that coronavirus takes to new victims has the virus riding in on the aerosol droplets exiting an infected person. Tech products that are out there today are not effective at intercepting airborne live virus in real time, but we do expect to see such products by May. Right now, consider touch contact contagion. Let's say you're in a fast food restaurant and somebody passing by coughed before you got to your seat. Some of that contagion could have landed on your table. Maybe you touched the table for a little support as you sat down. It's a natural thing to do, right? And now you use that same hand to deliver some fries to your mouth. Ding, ding, ding. Transfer complete. Follow the virus from the walk-by cough to the table, to your fingers, to your food, to your mouth, and bang, you're infected. Because the surface was infected. So now the subject of interest is simply, how do you disinfect a surface? One way might be with disinfectant wipes. For example, and don't bother memorizing this term, quaternary ammonium compound wipes are effective disinfectants. Medical facilities call these quat wipes for short, but the thing that makes them easy to find is that stores carry quat wipes under brand names. So when you buy Mr. Clean wipes or Lysol wipes, for example, those are quat wipes. Wipe down the table before you dine and you'll know you're at a disinfected surface. But wait, don't restaurants already do that, wiping down tables with a disinfectant between guests? Well, yeah, many do, but there's a loophole there. It's time. How long between the time they wipe it down and the time when you sit down? And during that time, How certain are you that there is no toxic Tony moseying by to share the wealth of his or her infection? Here are some tidbits to remember about surface disinfection. First, you're not just touching tabletops. You touch doors on your way in or out. You touch money or credit cards and credit card terminals. You touch products on store shelves. You touch shopping carts or tote baskets. Did you also happen to touch the hand sanitizer dispenser? Do that every chance you get, at home too. Second, think of surface sanitizing the same way you think about rebooting a hung computer. Whatever was hanging around before is gone for now, but there's nothing to prevent it from coming back again. Surface disinfection with UVC and surface disinfection with sprays are alike that way. You can obliterate what was there before a treatment, but you can't really count on any lingering effect afterwards. It's a fresh start, not a fresh start with an immunity idol. Now, wait a minute. Haven't you heard about sprays that claim to keep protecting after you use them? Sure, many claim it. Some do it. And with that, you've just encountered two things about sprays that can be completely confusing. One is that not every spray has the same impact on every pathogen. The industrial stuff can come with pages-long, tiny font lists of viruses, bacteria, spores, fungi, mold, and cooties against which they are, to some extent or another, effective. Think about it. A fly swatter might be fatal to a flea, but just annoying to a fang-toothed fish or ferocious African feline. The shoe that crunches a cockroach can't conquer a cow. Bacteria that are orders of magnitude larger than viruses will respond very differently to whatever secret sauce is in a disinfecting spray. So there may be a lingering effect for one type of pathogen and none for another. Without research, any disinfectant's impact will be unpredictable in terms of lingering protection. So it may be best to just think in terms of fresh start reboots. And there's one more factor. Fibbing. In their eagerness to share in the coronavirus countermeasure gold rush, many disinfectant liquids make misleading or uncorroborated claims about their potency. Makes you wonder which cousin owns the, quote, independent lab, end quote, whose endorsement is printed on the jug. So, let's say you find one you trust and want to spray surfaces with it. You'll want an electrostatic sprayer, a wet fogger or a dry fogger. Might be a handheld bottle model or a big one with a backpack. And you may end up feeling like a cross between, an Orkin man and a Ghostbuster. Depending on what and how you spray, you may not get all the way up a wall. You may have to dodge spraying electronics. You may not want to go after shinier glass surfaces that the spray can streak. There could be a slightly tacky touch to what you feel when the spray dries, and you might want to think twice about inhaling those aerosol fumes. But today, sprays are just about the only way that most places can accomplish surface disinfection. High-intensity UVC alternatives are out there, and more coming, but those, too, have a few limitations. You don't want to use intense UVC on paintings, because over time, that could impact the pigments. You do want to wear eye protection and cover exposed skin, and you'll want to understand how quickly or slowly you must move across a surface at any given distance to accomplish complete disinfection. There's some fibbing in UVC land, too, when it comes to surface disinfection. The most common complaints are not enough power, or too much time, or leaving infections behind in the UVC shadows. That's almost, but not quite, everybody out there, at any price. Next time, you can share our contempt for online meetings and the ways people game them. You can also learn about some new ink and paper products that can help balance out the productivity that people lose just watching other people's initials flash. That report is called Lots of Online Meeting Cheating, and your participation is required.
Thank you, Marty. Coming up March the 20th, the 45th Trenton Computer Festival. It is the original personal computer festival. The Trenton Computer Festival, TCF, was created back in 1976 as an annual educational event with speakers,
forums and user group meetings, an exhibitor area, as well as an outdoor flea market. But with the pandemic, all that got changed. TCF 2021 will be held as a virtual event on Saturday, March the 20th, 2021. It will be a full day of learning and fun. TCF 21 is free via Zoom teleconferencing to all. Donations will be welcome and accepted to offset expenses. All you need is a personal computing device, like a personal computer, a tablet, and maybe perhaps a little difficulty, even a smartphone. The TCF keynote speaker will be Jerry Foster, and he will be talking about How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Artificial Intelligence. He is the CTO and co-founder of Plex Systems. This keynote provides an overview of artificial intelligence from its humble beginnings to disruptive force, with an eye towards the significant positive impact on our world. The website for the festival is tcf-nj.org for more information. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the Computer Club. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, March the 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, April 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, April the 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet. Their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, April the 8th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening.